talk tonight about spiritual short-sightedness. Came up today in a conversation, and I don't know exactly how that worked out, but somehow my vision came into that, and we got to talking about glasses. I'm thankful that such were invented. I know I would be in a different profession, different line of work and labor if it weren't for glasses. I could take off my glasses tonight and you wouldn't hear a thing I said because this Bible would be probably right up against my eyeballs to be able to read it. Unfortunately, that's a true story. I can wake up at night and have no idea what time it is unless I reach over and grab those wonderful little inventions so I know what the clock says. We know what short-sightedness is. We see it in our lives when we can see those things that are up close, those things that are right in front of us, and yet we can't discern, we can't make out, can't focus on the things that are at a distance. Anything that's separated from us, if it's not right here, if it's not right in front of us, it's not in our focus. I believe you can begin to see how that makes a spiritual application as we look at our own lives. Unfortunately, as we look around at the world, we begin to recognize there's a lot of people in this world that suffer from short-sightedness, both spiritually and in really every area of their lives. Whatever is right now, whatever is right in front of me, that's what I can focus on, that's what I pay attention to. But you remove anything down the line, maybe an hour or two later, sometimes a week later, a month later, whatever it may be. Certainly as we begin to look at into eternity, those aren't things we focus on. Aren't things we think about when you look at a lot of people in the world. And I want to try to learn some lessons from the Bible tonight as we go back to the Old Testament book of Genesis and look at an account that I imagine most of us in this room are quite familiar with, and that being Jacob and Esau. And Esau is going to give us a great example of one that even spiritually was short-sighted. He's going to learn some very hard lessons as he goes through life. I'd like to read this portion of the account in Genesis 25, verse 29 through 34. Just so you know what is happening here, Isaac and Rebekah are expecting children. She finds that there are two children within her womb, and even within the womb, these two children have been fighting. And as they come forth, Esau will be the one that's declared the firstborn. And yet, because of various circumstances that even began there in the womb, but I believe also were spurred on by the love of their parents. You go back to verse 28 there. Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison. Rebekah loved Jacob. Here the parents had them at odds because they had favorites, ones they loved more than the others, and so it just increased the sibling rivalry that was constantly between them. With that in mind, we come to verse 29. Jacob sought pottage, and Esau came from the field, and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, "Feed me, I pray thee, with some of that red pottage, for I am faint." Therefore his name was called Edom. And Jacob said, "Sell me this day thy birthright." Esau said, "Behold, I am at the point to die. What profit shall this birthright do to me?" And Jacob said, "Swear to me this day." And he sware unto him, and he sold his birthright unto Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils. He did eat and drink and rose up and went his way. Thus Esau despised his brother. As we begin looking at Esau, we're going to find one that indeed was spiritually short-sighted. One that could have, at least in the way that things unfolded, could have had a great lineage ahead of him. But he didn't count it very important in his life. He was focused on a very immediate result in his life. All he could see is, "I'm hungry. I want to eat right now. And you have food, I'm willing to give you whatever you ask for it." But what all did this cost him? Number one, I think we learn from Esau, when we are spiritually short-sighted, we lose sight of true values. We no longer see things as being important as we should. In other words, we'll honor some things as being very important when maybe they're not really. And other things will count as not being that important when in the grand scheme of things, they are. There's great, at least some debate over what all this birthright might have included in the Old Testament times. But certainly here it was the idea of being counted in the lineage. Seems to have had the idea of superiority or some sense of authority even over the other siblings. It counted for a double portion when it came time for the inheritance that this older son here would receive. Jacob, however, because he now obtains this birthright, he will be the one that we read of when it comes to the lineage of Christ. Here, by every right up until this point, Esau would have been in that place. And yet we begin to read in Genesis 49 and verse 10, not of Esau, who is the son of Jacob or Isaac, but you're going to read of Judah. The scepter shall not depart from Judah. He was the, excuse me, I got that messed up. Here, that should have come through Esau and one of his sons. Instead, it's coming through the son of Jacob. He says here, Judah, the son of Jacob, the grandson of Isaac. That's who your lineage is now counted through. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, or a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come. And to him shall be the gathering of the people. Here we're looking far down the line of time into the time that Christ comes, and we're told He's going to come through the birth line here of Judah. Not of the descendants of Esau, but of Jacob. That's exactly what you find when you go to the genealogies of Matthew chapter 1. You won't find Esau. Instead, you find Jacob. Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac begat Jacob. Jacob begat Judah and his brethren. And so Esau gave up what could have been his, not only in the family line there, but certainly in terms of spiritual importance here that could have had him a place in that lineage of Christ. And yet he counted it very lowly. All that Esau could focus on here is, I'm dying of hunger. It's all I want to think about. And I see here a little bowl of soup. And it becomes the most important thing to me. So much so, he's going to be willing to give his birthright over just to receive that little bowl of soup. The Bible says there, in the King James Version at least, at the end of verse 34, that he despised his birthright. He counted it as something that was insignificant, of little value. He placed upon that bowl of soup a great value, upon his birthright, little value. And so you see here how he began mixing up. He became blind here to what was truly valuable and was willing to quickly give away that which was very important. I don't know. I couldn't think of a very great example that we could give here, but maybe you can think back in your own life at a time when you've looked at something and it became all that was important. It was all that mattered, and you name your price, I'm going to pay it. But then once you received it, you began thinking, this wasn't so great. Here I thought it was this great thing. Here I was willing to pay so much for it, and now it sits in a drawer. Now it's not ever used. Now it's of little value to me. But we can begin doing the same thing spiritually as well. We begin blurring that line of what's important and what's not. We look at the here and now and we say the things of this earth are important, but the spiritual things we count of little value. We'd rather focus on the things of this life instead of being the Christian that we should be. And I believe that's in mind, at least, as we look at 2 Peter 1 and verse 9. And here Peter has been listing those Christian virtues that we should add to our lives. And he comes to that end of that list and he says, but he that lacketh these things is blind, and he cannot see afar off. And he hath forgotten that he was purged from his old sins. He said, here's a Christian that should be adding these important and spiritual values to their lives, and instead he's not. Instead, we focus more on other things. He says we become blind. Much the same way that we can be spiritually blinded or spiritually short-sighted. Because we don't focus on that which is eternal. We don't focus on that which is lasting. That wasn't just a problem here for Esau, though. It wasn't just a problem in the Old Testament. It's not just a problem in the New Testament times. It continues to be a problem even to this very day as you think about that same idea here of Esau willing to sell his birthright for a simple bowl of soup. Satan continues to be willing and always has ready a bowl of soup that he's ready to offer you. He's always ready for that to become of great value in your life, even when it's not. The thing is, as we look at our enemy here that is Satan, we have to realize he knows how to offer those temptations. He knows when to offer it. Offering it just the right time. Of course, the great example we have is found in Matthew chapter 4, and you go to the temptation of Jesus, and here it says he's been fasting for 40 days and 40 nights. And what's the first temptation that Satan's going to come unto him with? When Jesus hungered, the tempter came unto him, and he said, "If thou be the Son of God, command that these stones be made bread." What would be your first thought there of a man that's hungering? He's been fasting for 40 days and 40 nights. It doesn't take too bright of an individual there to realize the temptation that would be laid at his foot is food. Surrender here, worship. Excuse me. Surrender here, and you put to test all that you are. You prove unto everybody all that you are. You show what's most important in turning these stones unto bread. But Jesus knew it was more important to serve God and do His will. Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. That's the enemy we have. That knows how to take advantage of whatever situation we may be in, knows that which is a temptation. And so we read in 1 Peter 5:8, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about seeking whom he may devour." The idea presented for us is not just something that's set off to the side and we may or may not ignore. But Satan is there and he's actively searching for those that he might lead away after him. He constantly has that bowl of soup and says, "Value this, the things of this life, more than that which is spiritual. More than that which is eternal." Again, you can probably think of another situation in your life, or maybe the same one we thought about a moment ago. We made a decision. Maybe we bought something. Maybe we gave into some temptation. Maybe we slipped up in living our Christian life. We did something on a spur of a moment. We sold out. We compromised in some way. Then all of a sudden we stop and exclaim, "Oh, if only I had had time to think. If only I had thought about what I was doing. Maybe I wouldn't have done that." An easy way to get ourselves into problems. We begin acting without thinking. We begin doing things in life without putting forth any thought into them. And yet that's why we have warnings as Christians here. Exercise patience. Exercise discipline. We have one of the greatest examples for us of a faithful Christian in the New Testament in the Apostle Paul. And yet he would say of himself, "I keep under my body. And I bring it into subjection, lest that by any means when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway." 1 Corinthians 9, verse 27. Now, dear here, even I'm going to be faced with temptations. Even I'm going to have to watch my example and what I do and what I value. But that's just what I do. That's what we have to do as Christians, is constantly be on guard. Constantly focused on that which is eternal, even that which may seem for us far off. Instead of just that which is right here and right now. Paul would speak, as he's writing to the Philippians, of those whose God is their belly. Those that are led around not by the spiritual attributes that God sets forth for us, set forth in His Word for us. But what do I want? What's appealing to me? What will meet my desires? And he closes that verse and he says, "Who mind earthly things." They mind the here and now. That's what they focus on and that's what they hold important. And so we know as we look through the New Testament, we're taught to count the cost. You probably remember this account as Jesus is showing us that importance. He's going to speak in Luke 14, verse 28 and following about counting the cost, and he uses this example. He talks about a man, if he is building a tower, does he not sit down first and count the cost, whether he have sufficient to finish it? Lest happily, after he hath laid the foundation, is not able to finish it. And all that behold it began to mock him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish it. Of course, we know the physical idea there. I've seen that, especially a few years ago, as we'd be driving through Dallas. I could point to some buildings for you. There was a technology company started building that building, but you know what? No one resides in it today. They went ahead and finished the frame, but that building has never been occupied by anyone. They started building, but they can't finish it. They can't even move into it, because they don't have the funds to be able to do so. Spiritually, then Jesus is talking about, what about us as we count the cost? You're going to come and follow me, you better count the cost. Are you going to stick with it? Are you going to make the sacrifices necessary? Are the things you're going to be willing to give up in your life that you'll follow me and not be distracted and not be pulled away by all of the things of this earth? But also, even as we think about that, maybe in a reverse sense, as we think about the temptations of Satan, that bowl that he might offer, we have to count the cost. Are you thinking about the end result here? Well, sure, you can take that bowl. Sure, you can take that temptation. Well, what's the final cost? What's it going to cost you? Is it going to cost you your soul? Is it going to cost you time and the effort that you should be putting forth to God? Is it worth that cost? Is it worth paying that? Yet our society doesn't have that idea. Our society says, buy into anything if the price and the terms are right. We look around, we have great examples of that all around us today. Part of the reason we're in an economic problems we are, at least if you... believe everything you can hear, which there's your warning. But it certainly seems the case. Part of the reason we're in the problem we're at is a credit problem. People will give you all of these things. Buy it on credit. Don't worry about when you're going to pay it off. Buy it on credit and don't worry about how you're going to do it. Get it now so that you can have those pleasures. Worry about the rest of that stuff later. There's a great spiritual application there too. Because of the temptation Satan will set before us, he says the same things. Enjoy it now. Don't worry about what it means for eternity. Why not just enjoy the pleasure here and now? And so Satan knows what appeals to us. Talk about food, we can talk about fleshly desires, we can talk about the temptations that lie all around us in the world. But even as was written for us in the Scripture reading tonight, those things won't last. You can file all of those temptations under these three categories you find in 1 John 2, verse 15 through 17. All that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, all of those things is not of the Father, but of the world. And the world passeth away in the lust thereof. But he that doeth the will of God abideth forever. Oh yes, Satan has a bowl of soup. And he's still willing to offer that bowl of soup, but it's just that. A bowl of soup that's not going to last. Just like everything in this life, it is temporary. It is short-lived. So he has that bowl of soup, but let us realize that we need to be focused on things that are eternal. Not on things that are temporal. Not on things that are just going to be short-lived. I think that's hard for us to grasp sometimes. You know, we look at our lives, and what are our lives? Maybe 80 years. Maybe for some, 100. And we look at that and we think, but I'm only 20. I'm only 30. We still have a long time to go. It seems like, especially maybe if you even go back, someone that's 10, when a 10-year-old walks up to someone that's 70, you're ancient. That's an eternity. You've lived an eternity. You probably remember when there was no whatever. You plug in the plug in the rest of the sentence there. You remember when there was no running water, and you remember when there was no TV, and you remember when all of these things didn't exist. They consider that an eternity. And yet as we live our lives, we begin more and more to realize how short the time of this life is. It's not an eternity. It's very short. It's temporal. But there is an eternity. And so that bowl that Satan offers, it's soon going to go away. It won't last. And again, the Bible's full of those lessons, but I think of Moses in Hebrews 11, verse 24 through 26. Moses refused to be called the son of Pharaoh. Rather, chose to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. I think Moses gives us an example here of one that looks at that question and says, I can enjoy all of the treasures of life here and now. Or I can look to eternity. And I can spend eternity with God's people. And I would rather do that. Even if it means giving up some of these things that I might enjoy while I am on this life. We talked about that. What do you find pleasurable? What do you take value in? Art and beauty, flowers, and gold, treasure, even diamonds. Look at all those things, and yet none of them will last. That might be what Satan's bowl is full of, and that's tempting for a lot of people. That temptation should begin to fade when we realize it simply won't last. And so what are we going to focus on? Is it going to be on God or is it going to be on something else? Again, as Paul is talking to Timothy, 2 Timothy 3 and verse 4, and he's listing a number of sins that people will go after. One of them here is lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. What is it of this life that you're going to value above God? What is it of this life that you're going to put before Him? What is it that you're going to focus on so much that you push God out of the picture? That becomes that bowl Satan's offering. That bowl can be whatever it is for you, anything that distracts us from God and so becomes our God. I can't give one simple statement that's going to apply for everybody. But it's those things that we begin to value. And a great example of that is found in Matthew chapter 19, verse 21 through 22. That a rich man came to Jesus, and Jesus is going to say, yes, I agree with you, basically, that you've done those things. I've already talked about you, but there's one other thing. If you will be perfect, go and sell all that thou hast and give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven. And come and follow me. But when the young man heard that, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. You see, here's a man, he's willing to go so far. I'll give up all of these things. I'll live a good life as I should. But give up my money in order to follow you, I can't do that. Again, as we've said before, I don't think Jesus is condemning money and the position and the possession thereof. But I believe this man shows where his heart is, that he'd rather keep the money and turn away from God. And Jesus said the correction for that, you go give away your money and show God that you're going to follow Him. You're going to put Him first in your life. And so what could it be for us? It could be any number of things. You know, sometimes I think in my life I've allowed certain things to become my God. I've allowed them to take a position that God should hold. What He's saying to me, Ryan, you turn away from computers. That's a great love of my life. Would I be willing to do it? Some of I know you too well, so I get to pick on you. Alan, would you leave your electronics and your radios? Peg, would you leave your crafts and those things that you enjoy doing? Barnum, I almost called you boys, I'm sorry, Caitlin. The Barnum kids, would you turn away from sports? Would you leave that behind? In order to say, I'm going to follow Him and not let anything get in the way. We need to ask ourselves those questions sometimes. It's not wrong to have those hobbies. It's not wrong to have those enjoyments. But it comes very wrong if that's what we put first. So Paul says in Colossians 3, verse 1 and 2, "If ye then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sitteth on the right hand of God. Set your affections on things above, not on things of the earth." Where's our focus? Is it no further than a hand can stand in front of our face? Or is it focused on eternity and knowing that is what is most important? Spiritual short-sightedness also we need to realize, and we've hit on this a little bit, but it insists on the immediate desires and gratification. That's why it's short-sightedness. It's because it looks right here, right now, and at nothing else. Think about the prodigal son. There was a bowl held out for him. It was Satan's bowl. He soon found it empty. You know that account he asked of his father, his possession that he shouldn't have had even until his father died, and yet his father parted unto him that which was his? And it says, "Not many days after, the younger son gathered all together, took his journey into a far country, and there wasted his substance with riotous living. And when he had spent all, there arose a mighty famine in the land, and he began to be in want." Here was a man, that bowl was set forth before him, and he said, "Here's the good life, here is fun, here is riches, here is fame, here is friends. All of the things you could desire." He didn't tell him that bowl's going to run empty, and you're going to be left with absolutely nothing. Spin that on down to the life of or lesson for a Christian. Turn away from God and you can run after all of those things of the earth, but when they're gone, what are you left with? The same answer. Absolutely nothing. Because the soul can't be fed with those material things. Jesus Himself said that. It was why He gave a parable we'll mention in just a second. He said in Luke chapter 12 and verse 15, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth." It's the measure of the world, of success. How much do you own? How much do you have? How much do you control? Jesus said the measure of your life will never be measured in material things, if that's what the world says. That's why Jesus closed, as we read earlier in Matthew 4 and verse 4, "Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word of God." That's what needs to be important to us. It needs to be what's shaping our lives. And yet, what does Satan's bowl offer? More and more and more. But it can only be enjoyed right here, right now. It holds nothing for eternity. And that's what a rich fool discovered far too late. That account's given to us in Luke 12, verse 16 through 21. But you roughly know the account. I'll paraphrase. He looked around and he had a rich crop that year and he says, "I don't even know what I'm going to do with all of this that I have. So here's what I'll do. I'll go and I'll tear down my barns and I'll build bigger and better ones and I'll just store it up and keep it for myself and I'll be able to say to myself, 'You have all that you ever need. You just sit back and be happy. Don't worry about a thing.' And yet God is going to say unto him, 'Thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. Then who shall those things be which thou hast provided?' So is he that layeth up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God." He had the same problem, short-sightedness. He looked right here and now. He didn't focus on eternity until eternity in a very hard way was brought into focus. He realized then it was too late. He had focused on the wrong things of life. And again, Satan's bowl is full of so many treats that look pleasurable. Oh, here are riches. They can all be yours. Just don't worry about what you have to do. Don't worry about what you have to compromise in order to reach them. You know, here is fame. Just don't worry about the fact that you may have to set God aside in your life in order to achieve that fame. Oh, here is, even as we look at our lives, we can say, well, here is fortune, here is fame, here you can rebel against your parents, against the laws, against God. Just don't focus that there may be consequences. Don't focus that they may have your best spiritual interest at heart. Here's one for all ages. Here are sexual immoralities that are going to be set forth before you. Just don't worry about the consequences that are going to come, the heartaches, if you don't follow God's pattern of marriage and those relationships. Here are drugs and alcohol. Just forget about the pain. Forget about the suffering it's going to bring to you and others around you. Forget about those things. Live for the moment. Anything that says you can enjoy all of this pleasure right now, but just forget about God. Forget about His will. It's an empty bowl, and yet it's still offered. So we need to understand spiritual short-sightedness causes us to make irrevocable decisions that can't be changed. That's a hard lesson, I think, in our lives. It's a lesson Esau begins to learn. And it says to us, you be careful that you get in, that you don't get in the same situation Esau found yourself in. That I'm so hungry. I'm so tired. I'm so worn out. I'm so angry. I'm so distraught. I'm so lonely. Fill in any sort of adjective there. That I'm going to focus on it instead of on God. Esau said, I'm so hungry that nothing else matters. And so, sure, I'll sell my birthright. I think he regretted that decision the rest of his life. We're going to read about him later as Esau is next going to learn here Jacob has taken the blessing that even should have been his from his father. You come to Genesis 27, verse 36, and he is angry. He realizes Jacob has taken his blessings, and so Esau says, is he not rightly named Jacob? For he hath supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and now behold, he hath taken away my blessing. And he said, hast thou not reserved a blessing for me? He's taken it. And yet he's going to look back on his life, and the Hebrews writer records for us in chapter 12, verse 16 and 17, and he's warning us against the same type of attitude. He said, lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. For you know that how afterward, when he would have inherited the blessing, he was rejected, for he had found no place of repentance, though he sought it carefully with tears. Esau learned here the importance and the consequences of making a decision. He couldn't change it. Even though he was sorrowful, even though he was seeking for it after with his tears, he was lamenting. He couldn't change the situation that he had brought upon himself. And now he's just angry. Angry, in fact, that it's going to lead him into what could have been an even worse condition. Because he's so angry now, his only intent is to kill his brother. Genesis 27 and verse 41, Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing wherewith his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, the days of mourning for my father are at hand, then will I slay my brother Jacob. He said, I believe my father's about to die and I'm going to kill Jacob because of what he's done to me. You see how one bad choice led to other choices that were bad as well? How it just had this snowball effect? We've talked often about David and how he made that bad decisions. He goes and he sleeps with Bathsheba. That doesn't work. Now he's getting his army general drunk in hopes that he'll go home and sleep with his wife to cover it up. That doesn't work. Now he has to send that man back out onto the battlefield and purposefully have him killed just in an effort to try to cover all of this up. One bad decision led to one after another. And yet those consequences couldn't be changed. And yet we have to learn there are consequences to our actions. I think that's a hard lesson as we're brought up in this world, especially maybe even in our society now. It says there really aren't any consequences. The other night as I got to talk with Jessica, we were talking about video games and how so many of our bloody and gory and all kinds of immoral video games are out there. And what do? You die, you make a bad choice, you kill somebody, you hit the reset button. It's all gone, it's all forgotten. You don't think anything about it. It begins programming our minds in that sense to think that way, I believe, even in real life. We go into our school systems and they're always willing to teach, hey, don't worry about it. There's always going to be a makeup. You can always try over. There aren't really any consequences to what you're going to do. We get out into the quote-unquote real world, and our law enforcement and our judicial system aren't upholding and enforcing the laws as they should, and we bring about the problem the wise men spoke of long ago. And Solomon in Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 11 says, because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Teach there's no consequences, then I might as well do whatever it is I want to do. Doesn't matter, because then we begin thinking in our minds anyway, God's not holding this against me. And it doesn't matter what I do, and that snowballs into all areas of our lives because we only focus on right here and we can't see that there are consequences to our actions. And all of those things we've spoken about tonight, those bad choices that we could make in our lives, they're going to have actions. Young people that don't think anything about getting caught up in a heat of a moment now have to worry about sexually transmitted diseases and pregnancies and hurt relationships, and they can't go back and undo that. People that are at the office and they don't think anything about the flirtation that struck up, and now all of a sudden there's an adulterous relationship that may be destroying our marriage, destroying our family. We never thought about the consequences. So many other things, the drugs that we begin in life, the alcohol that one might begin in life, and we think it's just one little thing and now you're hooked. Now it's destroying the rest of your life. You think none of those things have consequences until all of those consequences begin hitting home. Even sometimes we think about the words we speak and we think, well, they're just words until here we've spoken harsh words to one, now we...